To get there, start with the unique benefits you've identified for step six and ask yourself, why don't my customers value those benefits already? What is it about how they view their world that precludes them from appreciating those benefits as much as we think they either could or should? That's the view you need to change. And to change it, you'll need to provide them with an alternative view, the reframe, and then convince them that that alternate view, were they to pursue it, could either save or make them more money than they ever realized. And that's step three. After that, it's simply a matter of fleshing out the rest of the story to create a logical and compelling path from step two to step six. Put it all together and you get, what's currently costing our customers more money than they realize that only we can help them fix? The answer to that question is the heart and soul of your commercial teaching pitch. Building the insight generation machine. When you step back and consider the scope of what we're proposing here, you can begin to see how this approach reaches deep back into the organization. Yes, you need challenger reps to deliver the teaching, but the actual construction of the conversation, the unique benefits, the surprising customer insights, the tightly packaged teaching choreography require input from the entire commercial organization. Some companies choose to shield sales reps from the complexity of the six-step choreography altogether by simplifying the approach into three key elements. One, providing customers with game-changing insight. Two, specifying and personalizing the potential impact of that insight. And three, introducing your capabilities as the best possible means of acting on that insight. It's the same journey, but it's simply easier to process for reps traditionally accustomed to leading with rather than leading to. It's possible you've begun wondering, identifying unique benefits, segmenting customers by need, generating compelling customer insight, developing teaching-based collateral. For a book about individual sales performance, it seems like we've wandered a long way away from the individual rep. But remember, while this book is absolutely about individual sales reps and how they can perform significantly better, you still wouldn't want to leave any of these things in the hands of your individual reps. These are organizational capabilities, not individual skills. A critical lesson of the challenger approach is the significant need for organizational involvement to make it truly sustainable and not just the result of incidental sales rep excellence. Few but the very best of your sales reps could pull off this kind of teaching on their own consistently over time. When sales leaders first see commercial teaching, they usually tell us something like, I'm having a hard enough time getting my guys to sell, and now you want them to teach? Good luck. But it doesn't have to be that way. At least in terms of teaching, the most important steps you can take to migrate your sales force closer to the challenger profile have less to do with the individual reps themselves and much more to do with the organization that supports them. In fact, in many ways, commercial teaching is likely easier for individual reps than what we're asking them to do right now. Much of the heavy lifting necessary for its success happens long before an individual rep ever gets in front of a customer. To understand why, think about the journey from transactional selling to solution selling that just about every B2B sales organization has undertaken across the last 5 to 15 years. As part of that move, sales skills requirements have gone up dramatically. With transactional selling, reps sold largely on product features and benefits. In the new world of solution selling, reps probe for individual customer needs in the moment, allowing them to suggest specifically tailored solutions to whatever they hear in response. In its purest form, solution selling is customization in the moment. It's an incredibly high bar for any sales rep. It's no wonder, really, that sales organizations all over the world struggle mightily to help their teams make this transition. With commercial teaching, you can significantly back off on your expectations for individual customization ability as the organization steps in to offer crucial support around the very thing that customers have told us they value most in supplier interactions, namely the sharing of commercial insight. The rep's primary job shifts from discovering needs to guiding a conversation. That allows the organization to lay out the framework for that conversation in advance, to chalk the field, as one head of sales put it. There are a number of ways in which that conversation might still take an unexpected turn or go off the rails altogether. An individual skill is still hugely important in allowing the best reps to navigate those scenarios better than anyone else. But commercial teaching places significant guardrails around the sales interaction to provide real support for the rep. First, the customer's needs are pre-scoped. Reps don't start with a blank sheet of paper and diagnose each customer's needs individually. Much of that work has been done inside the organization through better segmentation and customer analysis, significantly reducing the burden on the one skill reps probably struggle with the most. Second, the conversation is pre-scripted. A teaching rep still has to interact with the customer in a live setting, answering questions and adapting to unanticipated objections. However, the rep's opening set of hypotheses is already laid out in detail, and every step along the way is clearly marked through the teaching choreography. Because the teaching pitch follows the same talking points again and again, reps will naturally improve as they learn from experience, becoming more compelling over time. In that respect, commercial teaching supported by the organization is much more concrete than running an open-ended needs analysis. It's easier for reps to learn and easier for managers to coach. Finally, the solution the rep is working toward is predefined. The burden on the rep to determine the right solution for an individual customer is significantly reduced as the solution is largely determined in advance through organizational identification of the supplier's unique benefits and needs-based segmentation of customers. One company we work with refers to these pre-built solutions as Happy Meals, based on McDonald's famous meal solution for young children. They're off-the-shelf solutions that feel customized to customers because they're well-tailored in advance to those customers' most common needs. Of course, this approach still requires greater skill than the simple world of transactional selling, but compare it with a world of classic solution selling or consultative selling where reps are expected to figure all of this out on their own. While your stars will get it right at least some of the time, your core reps will struggle mightily all of the time. But if you've done your homework inside the organization to build a solid teaching interaction to begin with, your reps are far better prepared to succeed when they're in front of the customer. So who should do the work? Commercial teaching is as much a team sport as an individual one. Just as you'll need to align individual reps to the challenger profile to make it work, you'll need to align sales and marketing around the core capabilities implicit in the commercial teaching choreography. Number one, identify your unique benefits. Number two, develop commercial insight that challenges customers' thinking. Number three, package commercial insight in compelling messages that lead to. And number four, equip reps to challenge customers. Commercial teaching also provides a concrete and very actionable roadmap for addressing arguably one of the toughest challenges in all of B2B sales and marketing, namely getting the two functions to work together in the first place. Given the chance, any head of sales or marketing will be happy to regale you with examples of the historically poor or non-existent collaboration between the two functions. At best, in most organizations, there is a thinly veiled antipathy across the sales-marketing divide. At worst, it's outright hostility. We've all seen the statistics. 80% of marketing collateral winds up in the trash, while 30% of sales time is spent reproducing the very collateral they just threw away. The underlying cause of much of this discord typically goes unaddressed. Most companies fail to define an agreed-upon framework for what the two functions should actually do together in the first place. Many commercial executives who lament the need for greater sales and marketing integration fail to consider the problem from the opposite perspective, which is, what shouldn't they do together? Commercial teaching provides a roadmap for integrating around a limited number of activities that truly matter. The approach defines a very specific framework for what good looks like for the entire commercial organization, allowing for the identification of concrete roles, tasks, goals, and responsibilities. For example, only marketing has the tools, the expertise, and the time to generate the insights necessary to challenge customers both scalably and repeatedly. As the head of marketing at a large telecommunications company put it, marketing must serve as the insight generation machine that keeps reps well equipped with quality teaching material that customers will find compelling. Sales, on the other hand, will have to ensure that reps have the knowledge, the skills, and coaching necessary to go out and use that insight in a convincing manner to actually challenge customers. It's a symbiotic relationship, around a core principle. Either way, at the end of the day, your message library, your collateral, and your pitch can't be static. They must constantly evolve to stay current with the customer's business environment and with a competitive, dynamic landscape. This is a big job. Hundreds of products, dozens of customer segments, multiple channels, and a customer environment that evolves on a quarterly basis. Therefore, commercial teaching isn't a one-time exercise, it's an always-on capability. With input from the sales force and at their behest, organizations must invest in training marketers to articulate differentiators and constantly source fresh and compelling teaching messages. So what does commercial teaching look like and feel like in reality? Now that we've laid out the theory of the approach, we can see it in action at two real companies, W.W. Grainger Incorporated and ADP Dealer Services. Commercial teaching case study number one, W.W. Grainger Incorporated and the power of planning the unplanned. W.W. Grainger Incorporated, based in Lake Forest, Illinois, is a $7 billion distributor of maintenance, repair, and operations, or MRO, equipment and supplies, serving nearly 2 million companies, primarily across the United States and Canada. Grainger provides one-stop shopping for the wide range of equipment companies need to keep their facilities, plants, and offices running safely, smoothly, and efficiently. All told, the company stocks several hundred thousand different products, from tools, pumps, and safety supplies to electrical equipment and janitorial supplies, which they deliver through branches, a heavily trafficked e-store, and, of course, the famous Grainger product catalog. Much of its sales volume is driven by both inside and field-based sales reps working with customers to establish long-term customer purchase agreements. As powerful as Grainger's broad product portfolio can be in serving customers' many and diverse needs, the company's impressive scope can be overwhelming. Faced with such a daunting array of choices, over the years, some customers have slipped into buying individual products reactively, based simply on past purchase patterns and opportunistic need, rather than taking the time to sit down with Grainger and consider how to manage their overall MRO spend more wisely, despite the fact that many companies' total MRO spend can easily reach into tens of millions of dollars. In the view of many customers, it's just a bunch of hammers, gloves, light bulbs, pumps, and generators. We've got more important things to do, the thinking goes, than spend our time worrying about that stuff. The result for Grainger? Over time, many customers have come to think of Grainger merely as a transactional supplier rather than a strategic partner. Need a hammer? Go to Grainger. Need a pump? Go to Grainger. Need business advice on competing more effectively? Not so much. It simply never occurred to many customers that Grainger might be able to help them with anything beyond great products at great prices. So when it came time for those customers to renew their contracts, that's what they wanted to talk about. Price. Now, you could argue that there are certainly worse problems to have than customers who think about you primarily as the company with great products at great prices. But if your primary goal as a business is to drive deeper customer relationships through broader, more strategic solutions, it's actually a pretty tough place to be. It's hard to drive organic growth and deepen customer relationships when your customers think of you by and large as a transactional supplier of relatively unimportant products. In the end, you become relegated to the customer's facilities management team, or worse, procurement, where you wind up haggling over short-term pricing rather than long-term value creation. So Grainger had a problem. As Deborah Oler, Grainger's vice president and general manager of Grainger brand, put it, if the company was going to establish itself as a true solutions provider in the minds of its customers, it had to change the way those customers thought about the company. They needed to build a convincing story not about how Grainger can sell you more hammers, but about how it can help you improve your bottom line by saving you money. To do that, Grainger first had to solve an even bigger challenge. The real problem wasn't so much that customers failed to think about Grainger strategically, but that they failed to think about their own MRO spend strategically. It's hard to be perceived as an important partner when your customer thinks of you only as touching an unimportant part of the business. So long before Grainger could change customers' minds about how they thought about it, they first had to change customers' minds about how they thought about themselves. They had to show them that the millions of dollars they spend every year in MRO purchases is not only a sizable investment, but more important, one that, if managed properly, could save them millions of dollars. Indeed, in tracking customers' purchase habits for several years, Granger had discovered that most companies were purchasing MRO products extremely inefficiently, and those habits were costing them millions of dollars that they had no idea they could be saving. In other words, Granger had discovered an opportunity to teach customers something new about their business, a way to rethink MRO spend, that could free up huge amounts of cash they could then use on much more important things than hammers. In terms of insight, they had a slam dunk. In terms of commercial teaching, however, Granger needed the other crucial piece of the story. Before teaching customers how to save millions of dollars by thinking differently about their MRO spend, Granger had to make sure that this insight naturally led customers to prefer Granger over the wide range of alternative MRO suppliers. To do that, Deb and the team first had to answer the single question, why should our customers buy from us over anyone else? As it turned out, that one question wasn't nearly as easy to answer as they'd anticipated. As Deb tells it, one colleague suggested, for example, that they tout their massive product line as truly differentiating. Whereupon Deb asked, do none of our competitors offer a wide range of products? No, the answer came back. There are a few guys out there that have a pretty wide range of products as well, at least for some of the categories we serve. That won't work then. What else is there? Deb asked. Well, we've got stores all over the country. Wherever you are, you can find a Granger branch. So customers can't meet their MRO needs through other retail outlets? Deb asked. No, there are other companies out there with stores. Well, then that's not it either. What else? And around they went, looking for that set of capabilities that truly set Granger apart. And frankly, it proved to be much harder than most on the team would have thought. As Deb put it, for a while, it really took us to a dark place. After all, what were we better at than anyone else? Were we really any different? It's a difficult question for most companies. When you sit down to really define the specific set of capabilities that sets you apart, once you cross off innovative, customer-focused, solutions-oriented, market leader, great people, trusted, and rich history, all from your list, many executives land in the same dark place Granger did. And now you've got to roll up your sleeves and set about the hard work of identifying real capabilities that only you can offer. For Granger, that kind of clarity came only after a large number of leader-led customer interviews, a great deal of market research, some robust data analysis of customer spending tendencies, and a number of cross-functional brainstorming sessions designed to capture as complete a picture of market perceptions as possible. In the end, all of that work led Granger to two important conclusions. First, most companies were spending far too much on purchasing MRO products every year because they failed to appreciate how certain buying behaviors were costing them huge amounts of money. Second, while other suppliers might carry a wide range of products or maintain a convenient network of retail outlets, only Granger did it all, and on a scale that allowed customers partnered with Granger to eliminate those costs by avoiding unnecessary or cautionary MRO purchases. Whatever you needed, wherever you needed it, whenever you needed it, Granger could provide it, so you didn't have to buy it just in case. In other words, Granger's distinctive combination of capabilities put the company in a unique position to help customers free up surprising amounts of operating expense and provide a powerful opportunity to shift customers' view of Granger from transactional supplier to strategic partner. Granger then took these insights and built them into a conversation titled The Power of Planning the Unplanned, a world-class example of a commercial teaching conversation. This is the kind of content organizations need to provide the frontline sales force in order to make commercial teaching work beyond the star-performing challenger reps. In fact, Granger reps bring the Power of Planning the Unplanned deck into almost every sales call because it absolutely hits the heart of the company's differentiated value proposition. For Granger, the goal of this conversation is to change the way that customers think about the company. But to get them there, the Granger rep first needs to get the customer to change the way they think about their own MRO spend. That's how the conversation is set up from the very beginning, as a conversation about the customer's MRO spend, not about Granger's capabilities. So as you might imagine, the Granger sales rep requests the meeting in the first place in order to share some important insights Granger has learned about how most companies could save a lot of money simply by thinking differently about how they manage their MRO spend. In fact, if you look at the agenda for the sales call, what you find is from the very start of the conversation, everything is squarely focused on the customer. Remember, customers want to talk about their business, not about your solution. And that's exactly how Grainger positions the meeting. First and foremost, the agenda is laid out as a get for the customer, not a give. It's Grainger saying, we're here to help you think smarter about a part of your business where we have deep expertise. That's the positioning. Now we're ready to go. First stop, step one, the warmer. The warmer starts with the customer's challenges. So the opening is, we know you face a host of challenges every day, such as production line issues, workers' comp issues, maintenance and safety issues, especially those challenges that are critical to keeping your business open and running every single day. After reviewing a couple issues and providing some general color from other companies, the rep then asks the customer to select for discussion one or two that are particularly pressing in their organization. The idea is to get the customer pulled into the conversation right away and talking about their challenges relative to what Grainger has already seen at other companies. Grainger has found that this one page can lead to an incredibly robust and valuable conversation, all because the rep led with a hypothesis of customer need rather than an open-ended question to discover customer need. Done well at this point, the conversation feels less like a sales presentation and more like two colleagues commiserating about common challenges. It's a connection born of shared experience and a great way to start a conversation. Yet while the Grainger rep may have built a connection at this point, he hasn't actually taught the customer anything new. That happens in step number two, the reframe. To change the way customers think about their MRO spend, Grainger starts by breaking that spend into its typical categories. Tools, safety, lighting, janitorial, and so on. For many companies, the total spend in any one of these categories can easily represent hundreds of thousands of dollars or more, depending on the company's size. This will all look very familiar to the customer. However, what's not familiar to the customer is a completely different way to think about all of this spend. Using a relatively straightforward graphic, the rep shifts the customer's perspectives from vertical product categories to horizontal purchase tendencies, from what they buy to how they buy. They do that by introducing the need of planned versus unplanned purchases. The rep explains, planned purchases are products and parts that you buy very frequently, usually on a regular cycle, and budgeted for in advance. Unplanned purchases, on the other hand, are products and repair parts that you buy at the last minute, usually in response to some unforeseen need or problem. The distinction's important because what companies don't realize is how the unplanned part of MRO spend, the seemingly one-off innocuous purchases of an extra hammer here or a replacement pump there, can add up to a huge amount in any given year and actually have strategic consequences for a company. Grainger has determined from its research that a full 40% of a typical company's MRO spend is for unplanned purchases. When you add that up across all categories of MRO spend combined, unplanned purchase spend is bigger than any one individual product category, representing millions of dollars in last-minute one-off spending. Notice the rep hasn't yet built the full business case for why the distinction matters. That's still coming. But at this point, he or she has at least piqued the customer's interest. They're curious to hear more. After all, you've just told them that their second biggest category of MRO spend, unplanned purchases, is one they've never even thought to track before. Now they're wondering what that might mean for their business. Remember, the litmus test for the reframe is to simply get your customer to say, huh, I'd never really thought about it that way before. And the shift in perspective from what they buy to how they buy is a great example of how to do that well. Now the rep is ready to build a solid business case for why it matters. On to step three, rational drowning. Using data from its own analysis of several years' worth of customer spend data, Grainger uses the next several slides to build out the story of the often overlooked but very real costs of unplanned purchases. In fact, the Grainger rep continues, it's probably worse than you think. A huge number of the purchases you make aren't just unplanned, they're infrequent. Most you make only once, yet each one requires additional time, effort, people, and money to complete. This is Grainger using their expertise to teach the customer something new about their business. For the customer, it's valuable insight. For Grainger, it's an effective means to turn interest into action by building a rational business case that makes the customer feel real discomfort around a problem they'd never realized they had. If Grainger has a long-standing relationship with that particular customer, the rep will often review their purchase history with the company to ensure the story is as compelling as possible. It's hard to say you're different when you're looking at your very own data. So what's the impact of all these unplanned purchases? Well, it's pretty dramatic. While most companies work with a small number of suppliers for planned purchases, they often have hundreds of suppliers for unplanned purchases because every item is purchased from whichever supplier can get it to you right away. And the cost of spreading 40% of your MRO spend across that many different suppliers can be huge, as there's no leverage there. Every item is purchased at the last minute at full retail. Even worse than the additional direct costs of unplanned purchases, however, are the unseen but dramatically high indirect costs. The real cost of unplanned purchases comes from all the necessary but typically overlooked process costs associated with buying something you hadn't planned for. You've got to take the time to find the part, generate an invoice, call the supplier, place the order, inventory whatever you bought, and then run the paperwork and payment on the purchase. All told, any single unplanned purchase can involve 5 to 10 different people across your company and incur huge amounts of unseen cost when you add up all the time, effort, paperwork, and people necessary to buy it. More often than not, the very act of buying an unplanned item is vastly more expensive than the item itself. At this point, the customer is likely beginning to feel a little sick about all of these unplanned purchases. This is happening every day in their organization, and they've never really thought about it this way before. They're thinking, great, that hammer I bought last week for $17 actually cost me $117. If I multiply that by 40% of my total MRO spend, how am I even staying in business? It's meant to be a real gut punch, a rational argument designed to evoke an emotional reaction. But just in case the customer is still skeptical of the problem, at this point, Grainger turns the dial one more time. The conversation now moves to step 4, emotional impact. Now they make it personal. To ensure that the customer truly sees themselves in the story Grainger is telling, Grainger uses a slide they like to call the pain chain to illustrate how nearly every company acts when something important breaks down that they need to replace in a hurry. Let's say a hard-to-find coil on that 20-year-old air conditioning system in your CEO's office goes out in midsummer. Well, it's hot, and it's your CEO, so clearly you've got to get the thing fixed as soon as possible. So what do you do? Well, the first thing you likely do is call one of your go-to suppliers for planned purchases. Surely they can help. But after 20 minutes on hold, you learn that they've just sold out of that part and won't have any more for at least 2 weeks. So you try another supplier you've worked with once or twice in the past, but they don't carry that part at all. After 20 minutes on hold, a third supplier tells you that according to their inventory system, they should have 2 in stock, but they can't find them on the shelf back in the warehouse. Well, now you're really getting frustrated. 2 hours on the phone, mostly listening to really bad adult contemporary music, and you've got nothing but bad news to report to your increasingly impatient and sweaty CEO. Feeling a little desperate, you call the fourth and final supplier in the greater metropolitan area. They're all the way across town, but that ceased to matter about 90 minutes ago. Great, they've got the part. So you pull 2 guys off the production line, put the hastily generated paperwork in their hands, and send them across town in rush hour traffic to pick up the part. An hour and a half later, when they get there, they call you up, and they say, "Hey, boss, they actually got 3 of the things. You want that we should buy another one just to be safe?" Well, you never want to go through this again, so you tell them just buy all 3 and get back here as fast as you can. You use one part to repair the air conditioner. You put the other 2 in the back corner of the warehouse on a shelf Grainger likes to call the parts orphanage, where they just sit there and gather dust. You probably won't need them next year or the year after that. And when you finally do, the whole system is likely obsolete and needs to be replaced anyway. But if you think about it, not only are those parts that you'll never use, but more important, that's valuable cash you've just tied up in inventory that you don't actually need, simply because you never want to have to go through the pain of having to buy that part again. And that's cash you could be using for far more important things that you actually do need. Dramatic? Yes. But Grainger's story is completely believable and credible. That's because it's based on real customer behavior. This is where all those customer interviews can really pay off. More important, however, it's dramatic for a reason. The story is intentionally designed to generate an emotional response from customers. They need to see themselves in the picture you're painting. They should feel the pain as if it were their story you're telling. As one customer put it when they saw the pain chain, "Wow, you know us too well. We play a starring role in that movie every single day." And that's the point. To get the customer to own the story, ensure that they see unplanned purchases as a problem that absolutely applies to them. Now the transition into step 5, where Granger can paint the picture of a new way. To get to the actual solution, Granger transitions from the personal to the organizational. Now that's the problem with just one unplanned purchase in one category. The kicker is you do that again and again across every category of MRO spend. So even if you were able to get your hands around unplanned purchases in one category, the larger problem is still there. And no company is structured to effectively manage the spend across every category. But imagine if you could. The problem represents a huge opportunity if you can get your hands around it. Unplanned purchases represent a huge amount of unnecessary spend and unnecessary inventory costs. It's money you could be spending on more important things. And that's a problem that Granger, given its specific capability set, is uniquely positioned to solve for you. At this point, the conversation turns to how Granger can help. Finally, we're ready to start talking about Granger's solution. If you're an existing customer, they've got your actual data and can start mapping out a plan. If they don't work with you much, they use this conversation to suggest a diagnostic of your unplanned purchases. Either way, all of the hard work that Deb and the team did early on to map out Granger's unique benefits is now laid out specifically in terms of how they help customers solve the unplanned purchase challenge that Granger has just taught them they have. It's an absolutely fantastic example of commercial teaching because the heart and soul of the conversation is a set of insights designed to help customers operate more profitably. That said, did you see where Granger and its capabilities first come up in the conversation? Not until the very end. There's no mention of Granger's capabilities, stores, website, history, size, product catalog, anywhere across the first 2/3 of the conversation. That's because this isn't a story about Granger. It's a story about the customer and how they could put money back into their operating budget that they didn't even realize they were wasting. From the customer's perspective, the fact that Granger has a solution to the problem is more of a happy coincidence. For them, the real value of the interaction is the quality of Granger's insight. Customers come away from this conversation thinking very differently, not only about their MRO spend, but also about the role Granger can play in significantly reducing that spend over time. Granger is no longer the place to buy $17 hammers, but rather the partner to work with in order to avoid buying $117 hammers. By placing Granger's unique strengths in context at the end of a highly credible teaching pitch, the company completely changes customers' disposition toward their offering. But to get there, there has to be a flow to the pitch, a specific choreography. And that's really the fundamental shift of commercial teaching. It's a move from leading with your unique strengths to one where carefully constructed teaching interactions very deliberately lead the customer to your unique strengths. Your solution isn't the subject of your teaching, but the natural outgrowth of your teaching. Remember, from the customer's perspective, the real value of the interaction isn't what you sell, it's the quality of the insight you provide as part of the sales interaction itself. Commercial teaching case study number 2, ADP Dealer Services Profit Clinic Seminars. ADP Dealer Services, a division of Automatic Data Processing, is a leading provider of enterprise software to car, truck, and other kinds of vehicle dealerships around the world. When Kevin Hendrick, then the head of sales for ADP, first saw our work on commercial teaching in 2008, the company was facing a real problem. While the economy was still in relatively strong shape, the team at Dealer Services was already tracking a number of early warning signs in the automotive industry that didn't bode well for the near future. Not only had retail car sales declined steadily for the last 3 years, but more troubling, the U.S. car industry was facing a significant overpopulation of dealerships, the number of which in response to shrinking demand was now dramatically declining. Ultimately, across the 3 years from 2007 to 2010, the number of new and used auto dealerships in the U.S. decreased from 21,200 to 18,460. Now, if you're a provider of enterprise software solutions to auto dealerships, think for a minute about what those numbers mean. In the course of just a few short years, the company was facing a 15% decline in its total addressable market in a key market segment as potential customers simply vanished. Tougher still, as part of a publicly traded company, ADP Dealer Services was naturally looking to post strong organic growth over that same period. But how in the world do you grow a company in a declining market? That is incredibly difficult. Really, you only have one choice: aggressively increase market share while vigorously preventing customer defection. In this world, if you're going to win new business, you're going to have to take it from someone else. But that wasn't going to be easy. While dislodging an incumbent supplier is always a challenge, the company was simultaneously battling a rise in small competitors, each competing aggressively against only a specific piece of Dealer Services' broader capability set. As an industry-leading supplier, ADP offered a unique value proposition encompassing technology solutions for every aspect of an automotive dealership, including digital marketing, vehicle sales, service sales, and even parts solutions. Small competitors, on the other hand, focused on only one piece of that puzzle, such as software designed to run just the service center or just the sales office. These vendors approached customers with a very different kind of message, emphasizing vast potential savings by buying only the software you most urgently need. And as you might imagine, in a world of concerned customers looking to survive, that message was resonating strongly. Put it all together, and ADP Dealer Services was looking at a potentially painful year. On the one hand, they were losing margin to customers increasingly focused on cost containment as their industry imploded around them. On the other, they were losing sales to upstart competitors aggressively playing on those fears to drive customers into price-based, transactional sales of stripped-down, standalone products. Yet the true irony of the situation was the fact that at the very heart and soul of Dealer Services' value proposition was their unique ability to help dealers reduce cost. And if there were ever a time when this message should resonate, one would think that this would have been it. But that didn't happen. Customers simply couldn't see past the total price tag. Dealer Services reps would go into a sales call, leading with all of ADP's unique and powerful capabilities to save customers money, and the dealers would respond, "That's great, but I've got another guy that says he can do just the part I need right now for a lot less. I'd like to work with you guys, but only if you throw all that other stuff out and knock 30% off the price of what's left." Painful. It's no wonder, then, that when Kevin saw the work on commercial teaching, he had a bit of a light bulb moment. He realized that a large part of the problem was that ADP Dealer Services reps were leading with and not leading to. If Dealer Services was going to get customers to think differently about its broader solution, the company first had to get dealers to think differently about the costs associated with their software choices. Because ADP knew something about the implications of those choices that customers themselves didn't yet realize. In their efforts to save money, all of their investments in one-off software systems for individual parts of the business were causing them huge operational inefficiency and redundancy that was ultimately costing them money, not saving it. With that insight in mind, Dealer Services set out to build a comprehensive commercial teaching capability spanning two key initiatives. The first was to build a better story. While the company had a clear understanding of the unique benefits that set their solution apart, they needed messaging leading to those benefits rather than with them. So the company sales operations and marketing teams designed a powerful story called Total Dealer Spend, featuring a data-based analysis of the surprisingly costly but hidden impact of inefficient IT systems on overall dealership profitability. On average, they found, dealerships work with 12 different vendors, resulting in up to 40% redundant costs, costs ADP Dealer Services could eliminate through their single supplier solution. Not surprisingly, like the Granger story, the central goal of Dealer Services' approach was to evoke an emotional as well as a rational response. Dealers were surprised and often deeply troubled to learn that they were unnecessarily spending huge amounts of money at a time when they could least afford to do so. ADP's second key initiative was to build a series of customer seminars called Profit Clinics. designed to provide dealers with in-person insights into how to run their companies more profitably. The clinics were exactly what they sound like, free seminars offered by dealer services specifically designed to help customers assess the costs of inefficient and duplicative work created by overlapping IT systems. The focus is squarely on the insight. Of course, as you might imagine, the seminars are also constructed to follow a commercial teaching choreography. The one thing ADP Dealer Services does not talk about for the first two-thirds of the seminar is ADP Dealer Services. It's not about the supplier. It's about the customer. Just like Grainger, after a warmer, there's the reframe. In other words, the software decisions you're making in order to save money are actually costing you money. Then the rational drowning and emotional impact as the company lays out how disjointed systems create all sorts of hidden costs dealers never realized they had. Ultimately, this leads to a portrait of a world-class solution and a review of how Dealer Services' unique capabilities can provide that solution better than anyone else. It's a classic case of leading to, not with. Dealers love the seminars because they deliver exactly what's advertised, actionable, valuable insight that they can immediately employ to save money, including a set of specific signs to watch out for to tell when money is being wasted in their organization. From the customer's perspective, the fact that ADP Dealer Services happens to have a solution available to make good on the promise of that insight is almost more of a happy coincidence. This kind of support is not only hugely valuable to customers, it's hugely appreciated. It makes the seminar memorable and significantly sets ADP Dealer Services apart from the competition in the minds of its customers. And the results of that kind of differentiation through commercial teaching have been staggering. In a year when new car sales in the U.S. were down 40%, ADP Dealer Services revenue was down only 4%. Did they hit their growth goals? Well, in a way, yes, given what happened to the auto industry across those 3 years. But more important, at a time when the only possible path to growth was to increase one's piece of the ever-shrinking pie, Dealer Services did that and then some. But just as important, they won the battle not only of market share, but of mind share, significantly reinforcing their role in the industry as the best source for quality market-leading insight. All because they shifted from talking to customers about ADP Dealer Services business and talking to customers about their business. More recently, Teresa Russell, head of Dealer Services sales operations, told us, even with the improvement in sales throughout the automotive retail industry of late, the information we provide in these seminars continues to resonate. Whether dealers need to survive or better still grow their business, they're still looking for interesting ways to better manage their business. And that's exactly what the seminars provide. It's a fantastic example of commercial teaching. The single biggest incremental opportunity to drive growth isn't the products and services you sell, but the quality of the insight you deliver as part of the sale itself.
Chapter 6, Tailoring for Resonance. Why does this idea of tailoring show up in the data as one of the defining attributes of the challenger rep? We believe this has to do with the increase in consensus buying. In other words, the need to have the broader organization on board before moving ahead with a purchase that's arisen as a reaction to the push to sell more complex solutions to customers. The data bears this out and suggests that this isn't just reps complaining, it's the new reality of solution selling. Yes, the recent financial crisis and economic downturn exacerbated customer risk aversion, but the increase in consensus requirements is a trend we were tracking long before the downturn. What decision makers really want? Earlier, we discussed the findings from our customer loyalty survey, specifically that 53% of B2B customer loyalty is a product of how you sell, not what you sell. One of the fascinating things we were able to do in the survey was to split out decision makers from influencers and end users in order to understand what makes these two different types of stakeholders loyal to a certain supplier. Let's look first at decision makers, defined in our study as the people who actually sign the agreement. These individuals generally fall into one of two categories, senior executives and procurement. So what really matters to these senior buyers? When we isolate decision makers from the rest of the sample, and then compare the impact of the overall sales experience with that of the individual rep selling into the account, what we find is that for decision makers, aspects of the overall sales experience are nearly twice as important as individual rep attributes. Decision makers think of themselves as buying from organizations, not from individuals. So what does this mean for your sales organization? Of all the things that decision makers care about, topping the list is widespread support for the supplier across my organization. One way to think of this is that senior decision makers simply aren't willing to go out on a limb for a supplier on a big purchase, at least not on their own. At the same time, we found that decision makers don't want you to waste their time either. They want suppliers to be accessible, easy to buy from, and willing to collaborate with other suppliers when necessary. Finally, while we might have assumed that things like price and willingness to customize would top the list for decision makers, they're significantly less important than widespread support and ease of doing business. That's a hugely important finding, and it flies in the face of most sales training that emphasizes the need to identify and engage the C-level buyer. Your reps spend so much time and effort trying to go directly to the senior decision maker, thinking, if we can just get in that door, that's going to help us close the deal. But the best path to the decision maker isn't necessarily through that door at all. It turns out it's an indirect path that the rep needs to take to earn that decision maker's support. One that lays the groundwork with the customer's team, identifying, nurturing, and encouraging key customer stakeholders across the organization. When it does come time to decide, the decision maker wants to know he's got the strong backing of his team. In other words, the consensus sale isn't something you should be fighting, it's something you should be actively pursuing. You can't just elevate the conversation and cut everyone else out, because it's exactly that team input that the decision maker values most when it comes to loyalty. One final point. When we broke out senior executives and compared them side by side with procurement for what makes them loyal, we found almost no difference between the two groups. Not surprisingly, senior execs place higher value on rep knowledge, and procurement places higher value on reps not overstating the value of their product, but that's about it. Both groups prioritize widespread support and ease of use above any significant differences. If loyalty at the senior level is all about winning widespread support from the team, then you're going to need to understand how to generate that widespread support. You need to understand what drives loyalty for the team, not just senior-most decision makers. The key to generating widespread support. Just as we did with decision makers, we can look at what it is that drives loyalty for end users and influencers, those individuals who play a key role in the purchase, but don't ultimately sign the check. Managed well, these individuals are powerfully positioned to advocate on your behalf. First, when we isolate influencers and end users from the larger sample and compare the impact of their loyalty of the overall sales experience versus that of the individual rep, what we find is that, unlike decision makers, these influencers place much more emphasis on the individual rep who is selling to them. End users don't think of themselves as buying from organizations, they buy from people. So what is it about the people they interact with that makes them more likely to be loyal? The biggest driver of end user and influencer loyalty is the rep's professionalism. Most likely, this is the legacy of years of reps overpromising and under-delivering. You remember the increased customer skepticism we talked about earlier? This is where it's gotten you. Customers are simply looking for a professional, someone they can believe and someone they can trust. As one member put it, we want our customers to think of our reps as an extension of their own organizations, to view them as a resource, not just a nuisance. We really think it's that kind of professionalism that customers are thinking about here. But the bigger story lies in the next set of drivers we found, right behind professionalism in their predictive power, the ability of the rep to offer a unique and valuable perspective and frequently educate the customer on issues and outcomes. In other words, what you find is a whole set of high-scoring loyalty drivers around the rep's ability to help non-decision makers to recognize previously underappreciated or undervalued needs. Contrary to conventional wisdom, more traditional selling skills like needs analysis are much farther down the list when it comes to driving end user and influencer loyalty. So while sales organizations continue to pour time and money into helping their reps to ask better, more incisive questions, these skills prove to be much more weakly associated with loyalty, as customers aren't looking for reps to anticipate or discover needs they already know they have, but rather to teach them about opportunities to make money or save money that they didn't even know were possible. What the data tells us is that for non-decision makers, loyalty is much less about discovering needs they already know and much more about teaching them something they don't know. For example, something new about how to compete more effectively in their world. Customers will repay you with loyalty when you teach them something they value, not just sell them something they need. Remember, it's not just the products and services you sell, it's the insight you deliver as part of the sales interaction itself. When you think about it, these findings provide a very clear roadmap for turning influencers and end users into actual advocates for your organization. This is how you build the widespread support that your decision makers are looking for, by teaching end users something of value. Yet while a teaching approach presents a huge untapped opportunity for managing customer stakeholders more strategically than you have in the past, nearly two-thirds of suppliers report using customer stakeholder interactions to extract insight rather than provide it. As you might have guessed, most reps spend their time mining influencers for information on decision-making processes and priorities rather than empowering their potential stakeholders with valuable insight they can take back to their organizations. In fact, ask yourself this. How does your sales organization currently manage stakeholders and influencers? How likely is it that these influencers would find interactions with your sales reps to be valuable and memorable? Would they use words like interesting, new, thought-provoking, or game-changing to describe their conversations with your salespeople? Do your reps deliver value in every interaction? If you're anything like most sales organizations, the answer is probably no. Lest we leave you with the impression that insight is something only valued by customer stakeholders, it's worth noting that this strategy isn't lost on executive-level decision makers either. Yes, these senior buyers care most about widespread support, but as business leaders, they are just as interested in new ideas to save money or make money as their teams are. There's a huge overlap in loyalty drivers between decision makers and end users. It turns out that a teaching approach is an opportunity that serves a sales organization well, regardless of whom your reps are engaging with. Senior decision makers don't want their time wasted, nor do they want salespeople wasting the time of others in their organization. They want widespread support before pulling the trigger on a purchase, but they won't let a rep go out and build that support if the rep doesn't have something compelling to share. Similarly, in sales efforts that start farther down in the organization, with the end users themselves, these individuals are highly unlikely to grant you any access to their bosses unless they are supremely confident that you will add value once you sit down in front of them. The new physics of sales. When you put all of this data together, it has far-reaching consequences for sales effectiveness. One of the conventional strategies for building loyalty is to elevate the conversation to the C-suite. But of all the things that decision makers could care about when it comes to doing business with a particular supplier, the most important thing, as you now know, is that the supplier has widespread support across the organization. In the traditional approach, reps pull information from customer stakeholders in order to present the senior decision maker with a more finely tuned sales pitch. The link between stakeholders and decision makers is perceived as relatively weak compared with the relationship the rep can establish directly with the decision maker, so information largely flows clockwise from advocate to rep to decision maker. The emerging model, however, flows in the opposite direction. The best way to sell more stuff over time isn't by going directly to the person who signs the deal, but by approaching him or her indirectly through stakeholders able to establish more widespread support for your solution. The link between stakeholders and decision makers is significantly stronger, whereas the link between rep and decision maker is significantly weaker. The rep's ability to influence a sale in the executive suite is nowhere near as strong as the stakeholder's ability to do the same thing. However, just as important as the direction of the information flow is the nature of the actual information flowing through them. In the traditional model, it's customer-generated intelligence valuable to the supplier. In the emerging model, it's supplier-generated insight valuable to the customer. This is the new physics of sales. It's like the whole world is spinning in the opposite direction. And this shift begs an important question. Over the last several years, how well have you balanced the time, effort, and money you've invested in gaining access to the customer's executive office with comparable efforts to identify key stakeholders and equip them to evangelize on your behalf? For most organizations, that's a huge missed opportunity. While you shouldn't stop calling in decision makers, you now know that those efforts do not negate the huge impact key stakeholders can have on driving more business over time. And this is something your best sales reps, your challengers, do as a matter of course. Tailoring the message. From a practical standpoint, what all of this means is that your reps now need to talk to more people than ever just to get the deal done. And we have found that one of the biggest obstacles that core reps grapple with when it comes to dealing with a consensus-based buying environment is how exactly to tailor the sales message to these different stakeholders in order to achieve maximum resonance. For individual customers, tailoring takes on many forms. A good way to think about how to tailor messages is to start at the broadest level, the customer's industry, and then work your way down to the person's company, the person's role, and finally, to that individual person. Think about how well your current sales approach resonates at each of these levels for each of the many diverse customer stakeholders that your reps now need to contact. The vast majority of sales messaging out in the market is not contextualized at any level, let alone at each of these levels for each kind of stakeholder. Typically, that messaging is about a supplier and that supplier's product and services. So as a starting point, marketing can add a tremendous amount of value simply by helping sales reps to tailor at the industry and company levels. There are so many sources of information, and many of them free, that can aid a rep in offering, at the very least, some industry and company context to their sales pitch. What's going on in terms of industry trends or current events? Has a big competitor recently folded, or has there been a meaningful merger out there? Is the customer rapidly gaining or losing share? What about regulatory changes? What do the company's recent press releases and earnings statements suggest about their strategic priorities? When a rep comes in not just with a sales pitch, but with a sense of what's going on in that customer's company and industry, you've got the beginnings of a tailored message. These outer two layers are arguably the easiest ones, and when you see tailored messaging in practice, it's usually at this level. Much rarer is messaging that is tailored at the level of a customer stakeholder's role. And rarer still is messaging that's tailored to that individual, in other words, their personal goals and objectives. Reducing variability. Many sales leaders think of the ability to tailor to individual stakeholders as some sort of supernatural ability found only amongst their very best salespeople. For the rest of the sales force, the biggest obstacle to tailoring, companies assume, is their core rep's natural lack of empathy, sensitivity, or listening skills. But that's not the case. The biggest challenge to getting tailoring right is that it seems that there are so many different things a rep needs to know in order to tailor effectively. So if you call on new people at the customer and you want to make sure you deliver as tailored a message as possible, what do you focus on? Their personality type, their role, their region, their interests? The list of possibilities seems endless. So how do you narrow it down? How do you get from the amorphous cloud to a tailored, resonant message? As you'll recall from Chapter 2, two things that challenger reps tailor to are their knowledge of an individual stakeholder's value drivers and an understanding of the economic drivers of that person's business. A challenger rep arrives at the customer with a deep understanding of how individual stakeholders fit into their overall business, what their role is, and what they are worried about, as well as the specific, quantifiable results that those individuals actually want to achieve. Challenger reps aren't focused on what they are selling, but on what the person they're speaking to is trying to accomplish. Most sales reps tend to deliver the same message whether they're talking to senior decision makers or more junior end users, and usually that message is about your products rather than about the customer's challenges. So how do you get your entire sales force to tailor their approach to each individual stakeholder's most pressing needs? Let's look at some of the tailoring tools that help reps speak to individuals in their language about their context and outcomes. Customer outcomes are what an individual at the customer organization is trying to achieve, how they would define success as part of their job. These outcomes encompass the actual activity or responsibility in need of improvement, the metric used to measure that task, and the direction and magnitude of the desired change. Examples of outcome statements might include decrease reject rate by 5% on our high-capacity production line, or decrease the number of clicks it takes for a customer to find an answer on our website. There are some significant benefits to approaching a customer's needs in this way. First, customer outcomes are fairly predictable, especially in terms of a customer's role. If you can figure out what CIOs at five different companies care about, chances are you can use that information to predict what other CIOs at similar companies care about as well. Second, these outcomes typically remain fairly stable across time and people. If a CIO gets promoted, her successor will probably have similar goals. Third, for any given role, they're finite. In other words, you can develop a short list of desired outcomes and focus on the few things that that person cares about most. And lastly, the approach is scalable. Once you've learned it, you can apply the same concept again and again across a company's org chart. The best thing about understanding and mapping customer outcomes is that you don't have to rely on individual reps to figure all of this out on their own. This is something that can be determined centrally in marketing or sales operations and then given to your reps in the form of a tool. Soleil, a maker of soy-based food ingredients, has done just that. This company has found a way to focus reps' conversations with various customer stakeholders on the specific capabilities and messages that will resonate most strongly with that individual. Tailoring case study, Soleil's message to role mapping. Recently, Soleil launched an aggressive strategy to sell bigger, more complex solutions in order to grow their market beyond traditional applications. As has been the experience of most companies that shift from selling products to selling solutions, these efforts brought a much wider range of stakeholders into each deal than had previously been the case. Soleil's sales team was now talking to CMOs, VPs of manufacturing, procurement officers, and anyone else with a stake in their solution. This was a big change for Soleil's sales reps. However, the real problem was that reps led off these conversations with the same product and technical specifications they had used with the technical experts they had more traditionally dealt with in the past. But more often than not, these new stakeholders had no idea what the Soleil sales reps were talking about. The rep might as well have been speaking a foreign language. Many of the non-technical stakeholders would scratch their heads and say, "So what?" once the Soleil rep was finished delivering the pitch. These customers couldn't make a connection between all of the technical specifications of Soleil's products and what was most important to them. And that, as you can imagine, significantly hampered the company's solution strategy. Framing the personal win. To boost reps' ability to approach various customer stakeholders in a language they were most likely to understand, Soleil's first step was to document for the rep what these various customer stakeholders cared about in the first place. To do that, they went beyond general demographic information, providing their reps with a set of cards explaining what each stakeholder was trying to accomplish as a business leader. In sum, each explains a stakeholder's functional bias, their personal value drivers, and their economic context. On these functional bias cards, you find things like high-level decision criteria or business outcomes that a person in this role cares most about. Reps also get a sense of the stakeholder's focus, or those things that the person monitors most often in order to achieve the high-level outcomes that they're after. In addition, the tool captures the stakeholder's key concerns, the questions that that person asks day-to-day to do the job, the things they worry about most. This is incredibly fertile ground for building empathy and credibility. And lastly, the tool captures for reps the stakeholder's potential value areas. These are the levers this person might pull to improve performance. So if a sales rep is going to tailor the solution to this person's desired outcomes, these are the types of things that the solution is going to have to do. This is the language you use to sell your solution to this particular person. This is how you translate customer insight into something reps can actually use to tailor. With information like this, reps don't need to ask the customer the dreaded "what's keeping you up at night" question, because they already know. It's right there on the card. It's a clear, easy-to-use framework for each major customer stakeholder's context and outcomes, all laid out in a powerful but user-friendly format. Getting past the so what. That said, in addition to the customer outcome cards, Soleil provides reps with very specific guidance on how to position each of its primary solutions or product bundles to different people across the customer organization. Here is where Soleil makes tailoring very concrete. This is exactly the kind of help reps need to adopt more of a challenger rep posture. Soleil uses the tool to show reps the various customer stakeholders who are relevant to their solution, as well as the high-level outcomes most important to each of these individuals. The tool also shows the primary means by which that person is likely to achieve those outcomes, for instance, increase sales, increase market share, or build brand image. Finally, Soleil offers its reps some specific scripting, tying Soleil's solution directly back to what that individual is looking to achieve. This scripting isn't meant to be delivered verbatim, rather, it's meant to serve as a set of conversation guidelines to direct the rep to the specific language that will resonate most strongly with that individual. Using these tools, a rep will be speaking to the customer in their own language about how to better achieve the outcomes that they care about most in their context. This is also the kind of thing that challengers might do instinctively, but that the majority of reps struggle with mightily. And that's really the beauty of a tool like this. It's a tailoring cheat sheet to help the rest of the reps sound more like the ones who do this really well. It's simple, it's concrete, and it's based on context and outcomes. What's more, it provides managers with a way to scale tailoring across the sales organization. Making tailoring happen. Still, to ensure that the tailored message remains front and center with each customer stakeholder throughout the entire sales process, Soleil goes one step further. Once a deal has progressed far enough along the sales process and the Soleil account team has developed a project proposal for customer review, the reps use a template to both win and document customer buy-in to the project. This template captures the agreed-upon high-level project objective laid out specifically in terms of what the customer gets and the major stakeholders across whom Soleil needs to build consensus. Then, for each stakeholder, Soleil documents the specific outcome that the proposed solution addresses for that individual. For example, for marketing, the goal is to maintain and improve product quality and taste despite cutting costs. And then for each role, Soleil documents in writing that person's strongest concern or objection and the specific capabilities or actions that Soleil will employ to overcome those objections. The most impressive thing about this is that all of this is mapped out with the customer. This information is determined through conversations and then captured using this tool. Though it's not required, Soleil's very best reps actually ask the customer to sign off on the template indicating their agreement with the plan. That way, each customer is agreeing in advance to the value you're going to create for them as an individual and how the value is going to be measured across the life of the deal. As a result, when it comes time for the person to decide whether or not they're going to support the deal, they're not making that decision based on some vague sense of whether the deal is good for the company. Instead, they can look at this template and see exactly how it's tailored to their specific goals. And you can imagine what happens when the rep ultimately sits down with the top-level decision-maker to close the deal, and he can lay this document on the table. There's your consensus right there, all captured on a single piece of paper. In fact, even if you use it only for internal purposes, this tool still represents an essential yet typically missing page in any good account plan, a concrete, concise summary of how you're going to deliver your solution in a way that doesn't just meet overall expectations, but individual ones as well. In the end, Soleil's approach represents a simple yet elegant means of capturing on paper what your challenger reps do in their heads every day. Address each customer stakeholder as if he or she actually was the customer. Because in today's world of consensus-based selling, that's exactly who stakeholders are. Chapter 7, Taking Control of the Sale. So far, we've checked off two of the three key attributes of the challenger profile, teaching and tailoring. Our next stop is a look at the third distinguishing characteristic of challenger reps, their ability to take control of the sale. According to the data, this ability comes from two things. Challenger reps are naturally more comfortable talking about money, and they're able to push the customer. What we're talking about here is the challenger's ability to demonstrate and hold firm on value and the ability to maintain momentum across the sales process. Challengers are comfortable discussing money because they are confident in the value they will provide to the customer. There's really nothing that instills confidence like knowing that you will deliver superior value to your customers, and challengers have that confidence in spades. This means that the challenger has no problem respectfully pushing back when a customer asks for a discount, looser terms, or increased scope without a commensurate increase in price. In other words, freebies. Remember, the value that the challenger provides is built on the commercial teaching message. This isn't the same confidence one feels knowing that their company's products and services are number one in the market. It's a confidence built on the knowledge that you've taught the customer about a problem they didn't previously know they had. There's now a burning platform, one you created, and it just so happens that you sell the only solution to that problem. Being number one in the market is great, but unfortunately, it isn't anything your customers really care about. Challengers also create momentum. Their deals don't get stuck nearly as often in no decision land the way a typical core rep's deals tend to. This is because a challenger will push things along, always thinking ahead to the next step. When relationship builders come to the end of a customer meeting, they won't push hard on next steps for fear of ruining what was otherwise a positive interaction. But challengers understand that the goal is to sell a deal, not just have a good meeting. They're focused on moving ahead. This is also closely tied to the commercial teaching pitch.